and Mark Steiner were about to have a conversation with Walter Mosley. His latest work is a small but really interesting little book called 12 Steps Toward Political Revelation. It wasn't quite what I expected. I love the subtitle, The Potential for an American Epiphany Under the Rough Blanket of Capitalism. And, of course, you know Walter Mosley from all his Lena McGill books and E.Z. Rollins and many other works of fiction and very powerful nonfiction he's been writing, like Working on the Chain Gang and Life Out of Context, and joins us now. And Walter Mosley, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
I've been reading your pieces that you do in The Nation often that you've been editing and putting out. This, in some ways, seems to be like a cry for we have to get it together and let's look beneath what we see every day to figure out what the problem is and why we can't get it together.
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And you've chosen the notion of 12 steps. Talk a bit about that, because we think of that as addiction, you know, but this clearly is an addiction in some levels.
Yeah, well, addiction, yes. But also addiction, I'm looking at addiction as dependency. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things you're dependent on. You know, you need food, you need water, you need love, you need company, there are a lot of things, you need shelter. You could say I'm addicted to shelter, but that would be silly, mm-hmm. You know, because you actually need it. But there are things that America has and makes us feel that we need that indeed hobble us. It makes us, it hurts us rather than helping us. This dependency on America's notion of itself in the world, capitalism, and then, getting down to things like, fast food and cigarettes, and I mean, all kinds of stuff that we feel dependent upon that we need to break away from. One of the things, and I think that when I really began to think about it, is we feel dependent, we feel that we aren't smart enough, and that our so-called experts, we need them in order to navigate, the terrible waters of our modern world. And in truth, the experts are lying to us. And instead of trying to deliver us from the deluge, they're putting us further and further in. And so, to start off by saying, we have this dependency on this nation that's lying to us. Here are the steps I think that we can take to get away from that.
And you see it as personal as well as collectively political. I mean, that's what I found interesting. It's like mixing, I was almost going to say like mixing metaphors, but it's more than that. I mean, whether you talk about individual psychotherapy, what that's done for human beings, but how to turn that experience, that idea, into altering a collective consciousness in this country.
Yeah, well, I think that, it's all good and well to say, go to college, you separate things. Well, there's, psychotherapy, there's political science, there's biology, and these are all different things. And indeed, in college, that's true. But in life, it's me and it's my society. It's how I see myself and how the world sees me and how I see the world. And so I've had to try to put all those things together. I said, we live in capitalism. We're dominated by the economic infrastructure, but each of us individually have to understand what's cost, what's value. We also have to understand how, if we're dependent on something, we have to understand how we feel that dependency and how much it doesn't really address the issues that we have.
So when you think about this, and I want to read pieces from your book and kind of wrestle with some of the things you wrote, but when you think about, when you address this, I mean, how does humankind, in the face of the onslaught right now of capitalism and market capitalism especially, that defines us from childhood, from birth, as you said, and we need to kind of free ourselves of that? I mean, I can see
the first step, which is why I've written this book in such, pretty simple terms, is that we have to start talking about it. We have to identify it. And we have to begin to understand, in our own terms, each individually, what capitalism is and how it's affecting us. Also, in when you start looking through the many ways, I mean, one of the points in this book, I could go back, I would underscore it,
mm-hmm.
Is the notion of democracy. Because, see, most Americans, you know, are confused. Like, most Americans think they're middle class, but really they're working class. Most Americans think they're a citizen of a democracy, but really they're a denizen of an oligarchy. And our understanding of democracy, and this is still answering your question, our understanding of democracy is that, you know, we go into a little, you know, booth with a muslin curtain behind us once every 4 years and make an X, you know, either with a pencil or a computer. It doesn't really matter what you make it with. Mm-hmm. That's not democracy. That, I mean, it was democracy in the last part of the 19th century, but when you're in the beginning of the 21st century, we're in the world of Facebook. We could actually, as a nation, meet once a week, you know, on the internet, and at least, if not vote, at least express our opinions about what's happening, you know. And I completely believe that all Americans, from, you know, the white Aryan separatist in Idaho to the black nationalist separatist in Detroit, want mostly the same things: living wage, medical insurance, ability to age with dignity, protection for our children and ourselves. You know, we're living, you know, we're all living in the same world here.
That you said a couple things here, and it's so much. And it's a teeny book, but there's a lot here to wrestle with, I think. And let me jump to what you just said, and then come back to this notion about how this world of capitalism we live under in America now, in the West, masks itself as democracy and what that does to us. But going to what you just said, there was a really interesting chapter that you had in there where you kind of wanted people to wrestle with the notion of class and understanding that people who may be against abortion or pro-choice or pro-gun or anti-eating meat really are being set up to fight each other over issues that we don't have to fight about on this level. And
exactly.
We're
actually fighting for our survival over issues which aren't anywhere near the top of our list.
So I mean, and that is something, you know, maybe it harkened me back to the years in the 60s, post-Vietnam, during the Poor People's Campaign, of trying to bridge gaps between white and black and
folks who may have
been racist white folks down south and civil rights and black folks in the north and the south coming together in Resurrection City, who actually did that.
Yeah.
Do you know, at that moment. So the question is, how we get there?
Well, you know, my message, you see, I'm kind of a rationalist in my approach, and so I don't really have an emotional approach to it. I mean, for me, it's just true. All working class and poor people, which make up 80% of America, have the same issues. We just do. I mean, that's a fact, you know, starting off from that moment. Well, if I were able to connect us, rather than through the interest corporations, the Republican and the Democratic parties, if I could have a democracy initiative online, and I tell everybody, look, okay, just tell me what your 10 most important things are, the most important things in your life, you know, not the things you feel more passionately about, but the most important things, you know, like you might feel very passionately about, you know, having a discrimination or separation of the races, but is feeding your child more important than that, you know, and of course, people are going to say, yes, of course, feeding my child is more important than that. So if you could say your 10 most important things and then vote completely blind about who everybody else you're voting with is, according to what's most important to you, Americans will come together. They say, well, definitely we need a living wage. Well, definitely when I go to the doctor, I want him to take care of me and give me the best care possible. Well, definitely I want to be able to retire at the age of 59. You know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that, listen, there's not even a question. And we'll all agree. Now, of course, people are still going to argue over abortion rights. They're still going to argue over, you know, the right to, you know, bear arms, all this stuff. But those are really lesser issues than, am I going to eat tonight? Am I going to be able to retire? You know? I mean, I could bring up a thing like, you know, planned obsolescence. There's nobody in America who works for a living and buys things on credit, who wants planned obsolescence. You know, it doesn't matter if you're white or black or male or female or, you know, you're not the so-called illegal alien, whatever. When you buy something, you want that thing to work. And when I look at the major issues, you know, that dominate us, I think that we're all in agreement, really. And listen, if we got online once a week, like on a kind of a federal Facebook to express our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think most Americans would say, "Well, listen, if we're going to fight a war, we need to have a draft." You know, the everyday, the rank and file. I think that we could really change America if we would take democracy back. But you know, they, and this is, you know, our elected officials and their masters, which on both on the Democratic and Republican side are the corporations. They want to keep us in the 19th century in the way we vote, in the way that we make decisions. So they have the power, and we have nothing.
Your idea. This is part of your idea about the Democracy Initiative,
yeah. Right?
Creating a way on the web for us to begin to have this dialogue. The dialogue that crosses all kinds of lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crosses lines without us, rather than us fighting each other, us helping each other. So, well, what do we agree on? Let's start there. What do we agree on? And then we don't have to worry about what we disagree on. Sooner or later, we're going to get to that point. And at that point, we'll have to deal with it. But before then, you know, the major issues about, you know, living in America and living in the world, you know, most people want the same thing.
I mean, interesting in your book, the way you describe this, you describe them as the Joes and we are the everyday denizens.
Yeah, they're Joes. You know, because the only thing I really disagree with Marx in Capital is when he starts calling the rich man Mr. Moneybags. Because using that kind of language seems to, like, you know, say that he's responsible for his evil. I agree that capitalism is evil, but to say that the capitalist is responsible for it, I think is a mistake. The capitalist is as stuck in his position as the worker is in his or her position. And I just want to call them the Joes. They're just regular guys. They're no different than us, except for they have more money, you know. And then, of course, we're not really citizens because we don't have political power. We vote, but we don't have political power. You vote once every 4 years. That's not political power.
And a part of that is, I mean, you talk about that we have to understand our worth. That we don't understand our worth. You spend at least two of your 12-step points really wrestle with the issue of worth, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cost of living and your worth. Yeah.
Right. I mean, but you approach it in a very different way. I mean,
it happened. I was listening once, somebody was saying, you know, we owed $8 trillion to China, and therefore China owned America. Now, the way a rationalist responds to a statement like that is, well, okay, so does that mean America's worth $8 trillion? I mean, if you say that they own us and that's what we owe them, well then, you know. And so I started thinking about what is the worth of America? And if you think about the oceans and the rivers and the sun and the wind, you think about all of the minerals and the intellectual properties and the trees and the animals. I mean, you start to think about the real value of America, and it raises above trillions, like quadrillions of dollars. Then when you finish doing that, you know, this is just public lands. We're not talking about private property. We just talk about, you know, public lands, what we're worth. Then if you divided that, if we found out that every person in America was worth $4 million, every taxpayer in America, every citizen in America is worth $4 million, well, then if I could tell you that, then you would say, well, if I'm worth $4 million, how come I can't get my tooth filled? You know? If I'm worth $4 million, how come my kids can't get a good education? How come I can't send them to my own private school? You know? You know, keep your charity. Give me what I'm worth. And once you, I mean, of course, you can't sell America and split up the money, but you can begin to say, well, I have to worry about the oceans because those oceans have value that can come back to me. I have to worry, think about things like natural gas. Well, maybe we could, you know, we could nationalize natural gas and we could have medical care. You know, there are all kinds of ways that we could begin to think. If we had any awareness of what we're worth. But, you know, I can't get anybody even to talk to me about that. And really, I'm sure, you know, Obama's, you know, cabinet knows somewhere what the actual value of America is. I can't imagine the American government doesn't know. But they certainly don't tell us.
Right, because it's the difference between our sense of worth and their sense of controlling costs and wealth.
Yeah, exactly. It's not ours. We this is our country, but it's not ours. It's a very interesting thing. It's like, this is my country, but it doesn't belong to me. Well, who does it belong to? Well, in the end, it belongs to the corporations who lobby our political leaders.
And it seems to me that, when I was reading this book, one of the things that it made me think about was that I was thinking about the struggles in the United States of America from the beginning of the revolution in the 1770s through the abolitionist battles and the fight to end slavery and the Reconstruction and the fight for labor and all the things at the end of segregation. And there was this kind of seemed to be a forward motion that from FDR to LBJ really kind of took at least political sway because people seemed to have some power, or at least the folks who were in charge thought people had enough power they had to begin to change things. Mm-hmm. But something's happened since then, though. Something's happened since 1970 that has begun to reverse that.
Yeah, I know. Listen, Nixon and Reagan and you know, the Democrats, too. The degradation of the unions and the absolute power of the corporations and the growing power, you know, of the corporations. Somehow we stopped working against cartels. This has been, you know, and there's a kind of a feeling after World War II also that we won, you know, and like now we're like the major power, the superpower, and you know, and slowly. Our economic power of the individual has eroded. I mean, you know, listen, when I was a kid, only one person in the family had to work, and you could have a house and a car and an education, all kinds of stuff. You bought a television, an old Zenith TV, and it worked forever.
Right.
You know? And slowly, you know, corporate America eroded that, gained more power, used political power to hurt the unions, and then to take over all of Congress. Because, you know, I mean, everybody, and so many people I talk to about this book, they're saying, well, you know, the Democrats are trying. And I said, no, they're not. They're not trying. The Democrats are doing the same thing the Republicans are doing because they're supported by the same people. You know, it's like the people who visit them every day, 365 days a year, are the people who represent the corporations and wealthy nations around the world, not you. You know, they only need you once every 4 years or 2 years or 6 years, whatever the cycle is, and that's it.
So
you know, and they use all these things. They use the newspapers, they use the television, they use their experts, they use their political leaders. Anybody from Newt Gingrich to Barack Obama, you know, I don't have any difference between them. You know, I like Barack, but still, that doesn't have anything to do with. I know that I'm not a citizen. I'm a denizen. I know that I'm being overwhelmed by an oligarchy that's only made up of rich people.
I mean, and one of the things you just said, and I mean, if you don't mind me taking a quick digression, come right back to the point of your book, which you just said about Barack Obama and Newt Gingrich. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot in that realm lately is that you know, people often move viscerally on the way we vote in America. Mm-hmm. And that the one thing, and I say this to a lot of progressives, no one's going to defeat Barack Obama precisely because too many people have bled too long to see somebody black inside the White House. Despite what he stands for in terms of corporations, that's an emotional feeling people have about Barack Obama and that family sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah. And really, and I don't care. I mean, listen, I'm happy to have a black man president, so I understand that. That's the biggest thing he's ever going to do. Be the first black president. But the thing that I'm saying is that if we had a federal Facebook, and once a week we said this is what we think, it doesn't matter who's president. They're going to have to do what we want, because if once public opinion starts to mobilize itself, then we have the power. And yeah, you know, I listen. I don't care. You know, if somebody wants to tell me that a Democrat's better than a Republican, I know better than that. You know, and I know it's not based on white versus black or brown versus yellow or whatever the thing is. I know it's all about class. I know that. I know that you know, in the end, that's what we all want. We want to be able to, you know, go home to a place that's warm enough to have some food in the refrigerator. You know, and, you know, if I can't have that, or if I can't be assured of that, you know, if we bail out the banks and the corporations, and what they do is they fire everybody in America and then rehire them at 80% what they made before. Well, we're in trouble, and we need to deal with that. We know that's the problem. We don't need experts to tell us that's the problem. We don't need Barack Obama or Newt Gingrich to tell us that's the problem, or Fox TV or MSNBC. We just need ourselves. to start meeting and talking. And one of the great things about young people in America, because I do talk about how older people think they know and younger people really actually live the life that we're experiencing today. Young people understand how to use these tools. A lot of people come to me and say, listen, technology is dangerous. Look what they did with the voting machines. I say, man, they've already taken everything from us. You're living in a fool's paradise if you think you're a citizen. If you think that your vote makes a difference, you have to choose between a Democrat and a Republican, and they both answer to the same bosses.
So if, as you say, I mean, they take two things you just talked about, which is, mm-hmm. on the one hand, the muddled nature about how we look at class in America and how to accept and redefine that, and also one of the most interesting, for me anyway, pieces that you wrote, where it was your step three, telling the truth. And by the way, we're talking with Robert Mosley about his latest book, 12 Steps Toward Political Revelation. It's a 12-step program for all of us to take back ourselves and America. If you marry those two ideas, you talk about every day spend a little bit of time telling the truth, one thing even. And on the other hand, you talk about the muddled nature of class and how we dream about class in ways that are unrealistic. Can you marry those two?
Well, it's interesting because talking about one exposes the other. Because, the truth is a subjective thing. I say that people should tell the truth at once a day. I think that's all we can afford because, we live in so many lives.
Right, right.
That just once a day, that would, clear up the waters and would head us toward a good goal. Now, I might tell something to you that I think is the truth, and you respond to me in a way that makes me question my truth. Well, that's a good thing, right? One of the things, one of my truths has been that all Americans want to be seen at least in the middle class because they're doing well, they're doing better. That's the way they want to imagine themselves,
right.
They want to talk about themselves. Even if they suspect that it's not quite true, they say it. But for me, being the rationalist, I come up, I say, well, listen, let's define the working class versus the middle class. This is my truth. A middle class person, if they lose their job, has an economic portfolio. They can live the same life that they've been living up until that moment they lost their job for the next year or more. They can go to the same restaurants, give to the same charities, keep their kids in the same fancy schools. Nothing changes for them. A working class person, they lose their job, in 2 weeks their whole life changes. They have to sell the mortgage on their house. They have to start renting an apartment. Their kids have to go to city colleges, and they're eating at McDonald's. And if they don't get a job in 6 months, they're in big trouble, deep debt, and they don't know how they'll ever get out. That's the difference. Most people are in the latter in America. Most people, if they lose their job, they're instantly worried. Middle class people, they don't have to worry so much. Now, that's my statement. That's my truth.
Mm-hmm.
If you disagree with my truth, we can argue about it, and my truth will be altered. But I think that the definition of class will be forever changed for anybody discussing it. One of the most interesting things is, when you hear people say, "Well, I think a middle class person has $1 million," well, that's true. When McCain said that, he said, "Yeah, sure, $1 million or $5 million, whatever." He said, "Yeah, that's true. That's not made up stuff."
No. Because
in order to keep your life going, you need a lot of money in America because America's money's not worth what it used to be. And that's one of the things. The older people living in the past, man, that's $1 million. $1 million is not a lot of money anymore. You got $1 million in medical insurance, you better not get sick twice. And so this is one of the things that every day we say something. And any kind of truth, political, social, psychological, emotional, it's working toward our health to be able to discuss what's true for us. And, and all of this stuff, ends up blending together. That's why I think that, we need to be able to meet once a week, not once every 4 years. And not under the umbrellas of the Republicans and the Democrats, or the racial separatists or the genderists or whoever, as people who live in America. And, I have a great deal of confidence in people in America. Most people on the far left and far right have no respect for America.
Right.
They have no respect. They say, everyday people, they do terrible things. I say, nothing is worse than Colin Powell pointing at the yellow dots in the desert. And most Americans know that those yellow dots could have been something else. You can't tell me that a yellow dot is a weapon of mass destruction. You might be able to tell me that it's nuclear energy. You might be able to tell me that it's a certain kind of gas. But just to say it's a WMD, that's made up stuff. You know? So my trust is in the people. My trust is in democracy. I happen to be an American. You know?
And
we've had a lot of struggles, you know, about racism and sexism and classism and all that stuff. But in the end, I think that most Americans will make better decisions than our so-called leaders.
And whether you're talking about what you see that our education system should give our children, which I found a fascinating series of ideas about what you think our kids should walk away with, or whether you're talking about the notion of genius and who understands what, which you talked about in terms of Iraq and Bush and other things, you have a deep respect, it seems to me, for the innate intelligence of human beings.
Oh yeah,
of that and that, but that we don't even recognize ourselves because how we've been so dampened down by this market capitalism.
Yeah, by the system. The system has tried to make us feel like fools and idiots. I mean, it's so interesting. Even the word genius. I mean, it originates a person who represents the culture. Because, you know, all these things that happen, it's not one person who came up with an idea and made it happen. It's hundreds of people. Mozart didn't invent music. And he wouldn't have been able to do music without thousands of other musicians and people who love music coming before him and after him. We have to understand that it's us together that makes this world. And it's not, you know, the really rich man, the really brilliant woman, you know. It's us together making the decision, you know. Because a genius can make a mistake just as well as a person of normal intelligence. But it's not one person making the decision. It's all of us. And that's what democracy is.
So do you think that we have to shed ourselves of the pain that it gives us individually and collectively before we can address it? I mean,
well, I think we have to begin to start to this dialogue that you and I are having.
Yeah,
is the most important thing, because if you in the end can tell the truth and say, you know, my vote really doesn't make that much difference in America. A lot of Americans feel it; they just don't say it. Once you say it, and you say it to other people, and you share that idea, and you feel, then you say, well, what should we do about that? And why is that true? And what is the next step? This is what we have to do. And we have to begin to articulate, because it's not a very difficult problem. Really, it's not a very difficult problem. It's not like, you know, we're in the bottom of a hole, you know, and the walls are slick with oil. You know, we are Americans. We still live in a democracy. We still can take back from what the government has taken from us. And, you know, and really, I know this because every once in a while, you know, I'll read some blog from some far-right guy,
mm-hmm.
a woman, and they'll be talking, you know, all this, you know, political stuff. But, you know, it's like there's so little difference between what we're thinking. It's like I was reading this guy the other day, and he said, well, you know, the problem is the Jew bankers.
Right.
And I was thinking, well, you know, I disagree with one word. The problem is the bankers.
Not the Jew bankers.
That's
exactly.
The problem.
Right.
It's not the Jew bankers. It's the bankers. And, you know, so most, you know, 90% or 95% or maybe even 100% of what they're saying, I agree with. You know, but the articulation, the racism, the this, the that, you know, it'd be, you know, and somebody comes to me and says, well, you know, it's the white bankers. I said, no, it's not the white bankers, not the Jew bankers, it's not the Catholic bankers. It's the bankers. That's the problem. And, you know, we get separated by these, you know, tiny little things. It don't even matter. Man, come, don't worry about, you know, what their, you know, religion or race is, man. Let's just worry about dealing with the bankers. Later on, if you want to worry about religion or race, that's you can't, because this is a free country. You can think whatever you want to think. But let's do the most important things first. Let's say, let's not bail out the bankers. Let's bail out the citizens. I don't care. You know, if you think all the bankers are Jewish, fine. I know they're not, but it doesn't matter what you think. But let's just say, let's not bail out the bankers. Let's just say that, and let the chips fall where they may. And then we have power, real power. And we're only one step away from it. I mean, that's the thing that's so amazing. When you really look at it, we're really close to being able to have it. You know, between the democracy that hasn't yet been taken away from us, our rights, our civil rights, and the internet, it's just one step away.
Feel that way. When you say that when you posit that capitalism, the way we are now in capitalism, is closer to totalitarianism and fascism than it is being democratic, in the book you say, which led to unions and campaigns against monopolies and cartels. Do you see this world we're in as that kind of a seesaw balance that this might sound strange, but like there's no such thing as real victory. This is more about how to create a system in society that works for the mass of us, or rather than just a few of us.
Well, that's absolutely true, because there's no victory. There's no end to democracy. There's no end to the issue. There's no end to capitalism. You know, I mean, yeah, we're living in a world where it's not simple barter, where value is translated into money. Once that happens, you can't get rid of capitalism, but you can control it. You can talk about it. You can criticize it. You can tell a man, listen, when it comes to food and medical care, you can't have more than a 10% markup. You know? I mean, if bling, fine. You want to sell, platinum initials to wear around your neck, you can charge whatever you want for that. But when it comes to me going to the store and buying an apple, if it costs you a dollar, then it costs me $1.10. That's it. You know? And capitalism will accept that because, you know, their whole thing is competition. So if everybody has to charge the same amount, well then they have to worry somewhere else, and that's fine. I don't care. I don't need to be rich. I just need to live a life that I can afford. You know, I mean, they raised my rent in Manhattan. I had to move out of Manhattan into Brooklyn. They raised my rent to $6,500 a month.
Damn.
You know, and it was just like, well, why? Because I could get away with it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's like,
right.
And, you know,
right.
I mean, there should be some kind of rule saying, no, man, you can't charge, you know, a person who's living in a house that much. You know, you can't, you know. Everybody's mad at Bernie Madoff. I just thought that was so funny. I said, what's the difference between Bernie Madoff and all the banks and the financial institutions?
Exactly what I said.
Same thing.
Right, right.
You know, it's just that you have to put a name on him, you know. But listen, a lot of people did that stuff, you know. I think that the thing about this book, which I think is the most important thing, is its innate optimism.
Right.
You know, a lot of people are cynical, but to be cynical, to believe that you have no power, that's a big mistake, because we have all the power. The people of America. One of the problems with identifying yourself as middle class rather than working class, well, if you truly are working class, once you are identifying with your enemy, and you actually are becoming your own enemy. And that's the only thing we have to stop. Once we stop being our own enemy, then we can start to progress again. So, and that's the really brilliant thing that the system did. It turned us against ourselves. I mean, in all kinds of ways, men against women, black against white, so-called middle class against so-called working class. You know, we've been turned against ourselves, and therefore can't move forward. Well, I can't vote for that guy because he might say that my son can get married to another boy. You know, it's like, come on, man. That's not the biggest thing. You got a union to worry about. You got food to put on the table. Worry about this other stuff at the end of that, not at the beginning.
So as you write, start the book, and as you finish it, just like the alcoholic, the addict, the things that obsess us, we have to throw off certain cloaks that stop us from standing up and being who we are.
Right. And you know, the weights and the dependencies that are put upon us, we have to, you know, get away from, we have to push them away. You know? I mean, really. And you know, it's so interesting in America because of the amount of drugs that are legal that they use to keep us down. So, you know, alcohol, tobacco, fast food, and of course all of the medications that doctors are now allowed to give the people to control their emotions. We have to get away from that stuff. You know, we have to say, listen, America is trying to make me a drug addict, and America's made most people drug addicts.
Mm-hmm. One level or another,
it's like bread and circus,
right?
Which is one of the reasons I talk about psychotherapy, because psychotherapy is straightforward. Doesn't believe in giving medicine. You know, most psychotherapists are not doctors. They don't give you medicine. They say, well, let's talk about what's your problem? What's going on with you? And we have to do that. We have to talk about ourselves. We have to figure out who we are and what we want and what's right for us, because, you know, the system is not going to do it. Capitalism says, I need your labor. I'm going to pay you half what you're worth, and I'm going to charge you for products twice what they're worth. That's how your life is going to be. And that's no life.
No, it is. I think that the way you put it here, it, to me, is really easy and easy to wrestle with. As a matter of fact, your chapter, I'm going to use your chapter on education and the ideas you came up with in that chapter as arguments that when you made education rights in your book, these eight different ideas about what students should walk away with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to use those in terms of in our discussions with people who run our school systems, because it makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, you know, really, because it's like I remember when I was a kid, people used to say reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know, they weren't far from the truth there. You know, the whole idea. You know, these notions, these theories of education, and you know, all this other stuff. You know, there are some basic things that children have to know. And we need to get to those places for those children. You know, I mean, for lots of reasons. You know, just even competing with the rest of the world. But if I know how, if I'm 18 years old and I can write 1,000 words to explain anything that I know, believe, or feel, then I'm way ahead of the game. And most young Americans can't, most grown Americans can't do that. But there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to.
Right.
No reason, not.
Walter Moses, you've given us an incredible book to wrestle with. I really appreciate your taking the time to write this. And also to encourage us in your book, by the way, to write our own novel, write our own stories.
Oh, yeah. Well,
to put it down.
To express yourself. When you express yourself, you begin to understand yourself. That's another giant step that we can all make. And of course, the last chapter, in which I just say, you know, people need to, you know, get groups of 12, just get together and start meeting once a week, once every other week, and just say, well, what's going on? What's going on in the world? Just
right.
For ourselves, how we see it, whether we're right or we're wrong, you know? I mean, listen, when Colin Powell pointed the yellow dots, he was wrong. George Bush, for 8 years, was wrong. Fighting in Afghanistan today is wrong. I don't care how smart the guy is telling me that I should be doing it. You know? You're 10 times smarter than me. Got much better education than me. But we're wrong to be fighting this war. And we're especially wrong to be fighting it with only poor people. Why aren't your young middle-class daughters over there fighting in this war? That's what I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's the kind of talk we need. Just simple, down-to-earth talk. It's not like an IQ test. It's not a Fox TV test, you know. It's not something that some corporation tells me that I should be thinking. I can think it all by myself. And if I get together with other people and do that, then I'm way ahead of the game.
Walter Moseley brought us, of course, E.G. Rawlings and Leah McGill and his political writings. And this is the latest in his political works put out by Nation Books. 12 Steps Toward Political Revelation, the the potential for an American epiphany under the rough blanket of capitalism. Thank you for these 12 steps. It's a little bit of an addiction recovery. And, of course, when you say gather groups of 12, has a little bit of a spiritual quality as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. It was great.